Iran's leader issues a congratulatory message on the return of an Iranian naval flotilla from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean. Yemeni army reveals the details of a new phase of a large-scale military operation to liberate the Ma'arib government from Saudi mercenaries. And Australia's third most populous state, Queensland, warns of a possible COVID-19 lockdown after a cluster of COVID-19 cases. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's leader has issued a congratulatory message on the return of an Iranian naval flotilla from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the return as praiseworthy for the country's navy. The chief commander of Iran's navy says the flotilla sailed through some 45,000 kilometers during the voyage. According to Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, the fleet, which includes the Sahan destroyer and the Macron Ford-based ship, has arrived in Iran's territorial waters. He says the Navy's top priority is to provide security for commercial vessels by sending warships to high-sea missions. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is set to visit Iran to hold talks on the country's nuclear program. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says Rafael Grossi will arrive in Tehran on Saturday afternoon. Grossi will meet with the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, on Sunday. The AEOI spokesman, Behrouz Kamalvandi, says cooperation between Iran and the IAEA is on the agenda of the bilateral talks. The two sides are expected to issue a joint statement after the meeting. The one-day visit comes following a report by the agency this week criticizing what it called the lack of cooperation on the part of Tehran. Iran reacted to the strongly worded report by saying that any non-constructive measures by the IAEA will disrupt the Vienna talks, which aim to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Our correspondent, Homa Liski, joined us earlier from Vienna and gave us more details on Grossi's upcoming visit to Iran.
This is coming at a very crucial time. It looks like this is an attempt that's being made to try and prevent the adoption of a resolution against Iran, because as we said there, Mr. Grossi, latest reports on Iran, two reports include two issues that he's mentioned, and he's been quite strong worded about them. And if the joint statement does indeed confirm progress or improvement in these two aspects, it could definitely influence what takes place from Monday at the IAEA Board of Governors session, if the US and the three European countries are going to go ahead still with efforts to adopt a resolution against Iran, or if what happens in Tehran on Sunday would actually change the course of action at the IAEA board, we'll have to see.
Well, the Yemeni army says it has managed to liberate an area of 1,200 square kilometers in the Ma'arib governorate in the third phase of a military operation.
More than 150 mercenaries were either killed or wounded. Also, a bigger number was taken prisoner. We liberated a very vast geography of those areas, 2,200 square kilometers. As you can see in the map in front of us, you can see the green zone that we see here that was liberated.
The army spokesman says the Saudi-led coalition launched 37 airstrikes to bring the Yemeni operation to a halt, but to no avail. The spokesman says the army is working to bring life back to normal in the liberated areas. Brigadier General Yahya Sadi vowed that the armed forces are determined to liberate all areas occupied by the Saudi-led aggressors and to guarantee Yemen's independence. A coalition of Saudi Arabia and its allies have been pounding Yemen since 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians and displacing millions of others. Well, two Turkish soldiers have been killed and three injured in an attack in the Syrian Idlib region. The Turkish Defense Ministry says the attackers targeted a unit returning from a patrol without elaborating further. Other reports say the incident was a bomb blast on a road. Idlib is home to the last major stronghold of foreign-backed militants in northwest Syria. The country has been grappling with foreign-sponsored militancy since 2011. Turkey, which has been supporting a number of militant groups, has carried out several offensives to clear Kurdish militants from border areas. Damascus has repeatedly slammed Turkish violations of the Arab country's sovereignty. Damascus wants the Turkish military to withdraw its forces and to end the occupation of Syrian soil. Well, the U.S. has removed its most advanced missile defense system, including Patriot batteries, from Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. The Pentagon has acknowledged the removal of air defense systems, but says it is maintaining, quote, tens of thousands of forces in the Middle East. Also in a statement, the Saudi Defense Ministry confirmed the withdrawal of the American missile systems. Well, the move comes as the Yemeni army and its allies and Saudi-led forces have stepped up their attacks on Saudi targets in retaliation for Riyadh's attacks and airstrikes on Yemen. The removal of the U.S. air defense system from Saudi Arabia also comes hot on the heels of the pullout of American troops from Afghanistan. Moving on to other news this hour, Israel says it has arrested two more Palestinian inmates who escaped the regime's Gilboa prison. And that brings the number of recaptured prisoners to four. Israeli forces said the escapees were captured in a truck parking lot on Saturday morning. Two other Palestinian prisoners were detained near the city of Nazareth on Friday, but two others remain at large. Israel has been conducting a massive manhunt since Monday when six prisoners tumbled out of one of the regime's highest security prisons. Meanwhile, Palestinians say they have shot down an Israeli drone west of the city of Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups say these developments signal a new round of explicit conflict with the occupying regime. An Afghan resistance commander has vowed that the fight against the Taliban will continue despite the fall of the last major opposition holdout. Saleh Rajasthani says resistance fighters in the Panjshir Valley will fight the Taliban to the death. He says the presence of the Taliban in Panjshir does not mean the fight has ended. Rather, it is just beginning. The commander urged the international community not to recognize Taliban rule. The mountainous region north of Kabul was captured by the Taliban last week. The group overran the Afghan capital in mid-August amid the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. Meanwhile, a new report has raised doubt on the U.S. military's account of targeting the alleged planner of a last month bomb attack in Afghanistan. The New York Times says it has conducted a video analysis that shows the suspect claimed to have been loading explosives in his car was actually handling water canisters. It also identifies the suspect as an aid worker. The report questions the U.S. military's account that claims explosives were present on the scene of the drone strike, which caused a second blast. The probe suggests 10 civilians, seven of them children, lost their lives in the U.S. attack. That's compared to Washington's estimate of three civilian deaths. The U.S. said it was retaliating against the August 26th strike claimed by Daesh that killed over 180 people, including 13 American service members. Now, from Afghanistan, we turn to Australia, where the third biggest state there may order a snap lockdown as the country posted a record one-day rise in daily COVID infections. Queensland state, home to more than 5 million people, has detected five new infections during the past day. Authorities say they will closely monitor the situation during the next few days to see if a lockdown is warranted. Australia has posted over 2,000 daily infections, surpassing the previous day's record of 1,900. New South Wales, the most populous state, has been under strict stay-at-home orders for nearly 3 months now. Police and military personnel have for weeks patrolled the streets of Sydney, issuing fines to those violating health orders, such as avoiding face masks. Well, Iran has reported more than 16,000 new coronavirus infections, a sharp decline in cases since the country was hit hard by the Delta variant. The figure brings the total caseload to 5.2 million. 444 people have died from the disease during the past day. Now, the overall death tally is hovering around 114,000. Now, this as the vaccination drive is gathering pace, with more than 22 million doses of vaccines administered so far. Iran faced the fifth peak of COVID-19 in mid-August, with the number of infections standing at over 50,000 and the number of deaths at over 700. The Delta variant is blamed for the surge. Well, the U.S. president has issued a vaccine mandate, which would apply to about two-thirds of all American employees. The decision has drawn criticism from senior Republicans who are threatening to sue the Democratic administration. In the meantime, the fate of the U.S. economy is hanging in a balance.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
At least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives.
And the U.S. government's mask mandate proved to be a divisive topic among Americans, with conservatives voicing the strongest opposition to it. The same continues with COVID-19 vaccines, as just over 50% of the country's population is currently fully inoculated, far below the previous projections. The other point of disagreement between the two political camps has been President Biden's most recent stimulus plan, which is being criticized as harmful to the economy in the long run.
Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. the Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road, considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs, because if these stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017. That gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors. They would have to raise taxes, and that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away the Trump tax cuts if they're going to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Since the Cold War began, Washington has engaged in an endless series of interventions around the planet, from Chile to Guatemala, as well as in conflicts large and small, says Tom Engelhardt, writer, in an article titled, Imagine Spending $8 Trillion to Rebuild a Society Instead of Destroying One. Stay tuned for more. They weren't kidding when they called Afghanistan the graveyard of empires. Indeed, that cemetery has just taken another imperial body. And it wasn't pretty, was it? Not that anyone should be surprised. Even after 20 years of preparation, a burial never is. In fact, the shock and awfulness in Kabul and Washington over these last weeks shouldn't have been surprising, given U.S. history. After all, Americans were the ones who prepared the ground and dug the grave for the previous internment in that very cemetery. Count on this, though. The politicians of the great power that hasn't won a significant war since 1945 will agree on one thing, that the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex deserve yet more funding, no matter what else doesn't. When on February 15, 1989, the Red Army finally left Afghanistan, crossing the Friendship Bridge into Uzbekistan, Soviet Commander General Boris Gromov, the last man out, said, "That's it. Not one Soviet soldier or officer is behind my back." It was his way of saying so long farewell, good relents to the endless war that the leader of the Soviet Union had by then taken to calling the bleeding wound. Yet, in his own strange fashion, that graveyard would come home with them. After all, they returned to a bankrupt land, sucked dry by that failed war against those American and Saudi-backed extremists. 2 years later, the Soviet Union would implode, leaving just one truly great power on planet Earth. Along with, of course, those very extremists Washington had built into a USSR destroying force. Only a decade later, in response to an Air Force manned by 19 mostly Saudi hijackers, dispatched by Osama bin Laden, a rich Saudi prince who had been part of anti-Soviet effort in Afghanistan, the world's sole superpower, would head directly for that graveyard. Despite the American experience in Vietnam during the previous century, the Afghan effort of 1980s was meant to give the USSR its own Vietnam. Key Bush administration officials were so sure of themselves that, as the New York Times recently reported, they wouldn't even consider letting the leaders of the Taliban negotiate a surrender once the invasion began. On September 11, 2001, in the ruins of the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had already given an aide these instructions, referring not just to bin Laden, but Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein. Go massive, sweep it up, all up, things related or not. Now, he insisted, the United States is not inclined to negotiate surrenders. Allow a surrender and have everything grind to a disappointing halt? Not a chance. Not when the Afghan war was the beginning of what was to be an American triumph of global proportions. After all, the future invasion of Iraq and the domination of the oil-rich West Asia-North Africa region by the one and only power on the planet were already on the agenda. How could the leaders of such a confident land with a military funded at the levels the next most powerful countries combined couldn't match have imagined its own 2021 version of surrender? And yet once again, 20 years later, Afghanistan has quite visibly and horrifyingly become a graveyard of empire. As well, of course, as a graveyard for Afghans. Perhaps it's only fitting that the Secretary of Defense, who refused the surrender of the enemy in 21, was recently buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full honors. In fact, the present Secretary of Defense and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff both reportedly knelt before Mr. Rumsfeld's widow, Joyce, who was in a wheelchair, and presented her with a flag from her husband's coffin. Meanwhile, Joe Biden was the third president since George W. Bush and crew launched this country's forever wars to find himself floundering helplessly in that same graveyard of empires. If the Soviet example didn't come to mind, it should have, as Democrats and Republicans, President Biden and former President Trump, flailed at each other over their supposedly deep feelings for the poor Afghans being left behind. While this country withdrew its troops from Kabul airport in a land where rest in peace has long had no meaning. Here's the thing, though. Don't assume that Afghanistan is the only imperial graveyard around, or that the U.S. can simply withdraw, however ineptly, chaotically, and bloodily, leaving that country to history and the Taliban. Put another way, even though events in Kabul and its surroundings took over the mainstream news recently, the Soviet example should remind us that when it comes to empires, imperial graveyards are hardly restricted to Afghanistan. Since the Cold War began, Washington has engaged in an endless series of interventions around the planet, from Chile to Guatemala, as well as in conflicts large and small. Now, with Joe Biden having withdrawn from America's disastrous Afghan war, you might wonder whether it's all finally coming to an end, even if the U.S. still insists on maintaining 750 sizable military bases globally. Count on this, though. The politicians of the great power that hasn't won a significant war since 1945 will agree on one thing, that the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex deserve yet more funding, no matter what else doesn't. In truth, those institutions have been the major recipients of actual infrastructure spending over much of what might still be thought of as the American century. They have been the true winners in this society, along with the billionaires who, even in the midst of a grotesque pandemic, raked in profits in a historic fashion. In the process, those tycoons created possibly the largest inequality gap on the planet, one that could destabilize a democracy even if nothing else were going. The losers don't even get people started. Or think of it this way. Yes, in August 2021, it was Kabul, not Washington, D.C., that fell to the enemy. But the nation-building project in which this country has been involved over these last decades hasn't remained thousands of miles away. Only half notice here, it's been becoming home big time. You can't tell a lot about a country if you know where its politicians unanimously agree to invest taxpayer dollars. At this very moment, the U.S. is in a series of crises, none worse than the heat, fire, and flood season that's hit not just the mega-drought-ridden West, or inundated Tennessee, or hurricane-hacked Louisiana, or the tropical storm-tossed Northeast, but the whole country. Unbearable warmth, humidity, fires, smoke, storms, and power outages, that's America. As America's eternally losing generals come home from Kabul, what we actually had in mind was the one thing just about everyone in Washington seems to agree on: funding the military-industrial complex beyond their wildest dreams. Congress has recently spent months trying to pass a bill that would, over a number of years, invest an extra $550 billion in this country's badly tattered infrastructure. But never needs time like that to pass Pentagon and other national security budgets that for years now have added up to well over $1 trillion annually.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Nigeria's president recently signed into law an oil overhaul bill that has been in the pipeline for almost two decades. Now, this law is seen as historic for Africa's top oil producer, which has seen this natural resource exploited by foreign companies without any benefit to the local communities. Now, the bill was approved by the Senate and House of Representatives. Nigeria's Senate President says communities hosting oil and gas production are the winners.
The host communities are winners as well. It may not be necessarily exactly what some of them had hoped, but, you know, from zero to over $500 million, I think it's a big jump. And with time, such issues could be further addressed. But I want to also caution That is not the $500 million that is small, but how we are able to prudently and transparently deploy these $500 million in the host communities.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenya. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the new Petroleum Industry Act in Nigeria and asking, will the local communities benefit from this long-delayed oil and gas law? In the second part of our program, we shall see how production of clothing, including for high street brands in Europe and the United States, is killing Africa's rivers through polluting discharges of untreated industrial wastewater. Join us till the end of our show as our guests give us an incisive analysis on these two subjects.
Nigeria's new oil law. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari recently signed the country's much-anticipated petroleum industry bill following nearly two decades of attempts and revisions. The new law is expected to overhaul the oil and gas industry in Africa's biggest crude producer. President Buhari said the new oil industry law marks the end of decades of uncertainty and underinvestment in the petroleum industry. He called for the implementation to be completed within 12 months.
I have approved an implementation framework commencing immediately to ensure the industry envisaged in the new law begins to take shape. The implementation process, to be headed by the Honorable Minister of State, Petroleum Resources, is hereby tasked with the completion of the implementation of this act within 12 months. I am therefore directing all relevant ministries, departments, and agencies of government to fully cooperate in ensuring the successful and timely implementation.
Celebrations over the new oil industry law in Nigeria were dimmed by controversy over the allocation of 3% revenue to host communities in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. Now, some community leaders in the region have rejected the bill, saying they will continue agitating for their rights.
With what they have done, they have not stopped agitation, they have not helped the argument, they've not resolved any conflict, they have created more conflict because the agitation pressure will only be higher.
Now, for more on the new oil industry law in Nigeria, we have contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, can you first tell us what impact will the Petroleum Industry Act have on this critical sector in Nigeria?
So the Petroleum Industry Bill has been in the making for over a decade, and a lot of people are relieved that it has come to be. But it may be a good sign for some investors, but to those of us concerned about the environment, it's not good news at all.
Thank you for that, Mr. Basse.
The governors of the 36 states of the country, under the auspices of the Nigeria Governors Forum, have described the Petroleum Industry Act as a recipe for disaster. The chairman of the forum, Dr. Kayode Fayemi, has expressed concern over 30% allocation for frontier exploration and the 3% for the host communities.
Our primary concern to me and the people I speak for is the entire forum of Nigerian governors. And this is a matter that the entire forum has discussed extensively, and we have come to certain conclusion about what is called frontier funds, whether it is 3% or not. For us, our concern there is that whatever you are taking into these places is a depletion from the Federation account. That money will not go to the Federation account. It would be spread across the few areas that you describe as frontier basins rather than to the entire Federation.
Nigerian governors have particularly rejected the amount to be paid to host communities where oil companies are operating. Can you elaborate on that?
Three major issues include the fact that the provisions made in the bill, in the law for host investment in host communities is very disturbing. the communities asked for 10%, while the Senate recommended 3%, the House of Representatives recommended 5%. Eventually, the bill that was sent to the president asked for 10% investment funding for communities where the oil activities are taking place. Now, the major contention on that issue is not necessarily the how small the amount is, but the fact that oil companies have the, they are the ones to determine who is a host community, who is a community that has oil facilities, and this excludes communities that just have only the pollution, because the entire region is polluted. Moreover, oil companies have the upper hand in determining who decides what the funding is used for. And we think this is very colonial and unacceptable.
Decades of oil spills and gas flaring have transformed the Niger Delta in Nigeria into one of the most polluted places on the planet. A Nigerian boy narrates how his younger brother died after falling into a river contaminated with oil that leaked from a pipeline owned by Shell, Europe's biggest oil and gas company.
My brother fell into the oil one morning. He was 6 years old. I saw oil all over his body. Oil came out from his nose, his mouth, his ears. He swallowed the oil a lot. When we went to the hospital, they could not help him. When we got home, we tried to feed him, but we couldn't help him anymore. He was already dead.
Now, Mr. Basse, you earlier talked about environmental concerns. Now, do we have provisions in the new law that will ensure multinationals adhere to local laws, especially relating to the environment, and compensation to local communities that have suffered over the years?
Well, the new law is blind to the environment. It's not really concerned about the environment. It's all about the financial management of oil revenue. It's about the investment in the sector. It's about attracting investment. And the only thing that suggests that something may go to the communities is a 3% allocation, 3% of funds from the sector that should go towards the communities. And now this funding is like giving with one hand and taking the same fund from the with the other hand, because another aspect of the law says that if there's an infringement, if there's maybe accident along the pipeline, there's oil spill and so on and so forth, and this is attributed to third-party interference, then it means that the communities involved will have to pay for the repair of that situation. What this means is that the oil companies who always attribute any kind of environmental misbehavior to third-party interference, trying to escape their responsibility, would continue to do so, and then the 3% allocation for communities will end up going back to the pockets of oil companies. So we see this as absolutely unhealthy and insensitive.
Well, Nigeria's Dangote oil refinery is expected to buy at least 300,000 barrels per day of the country's crude production. Now, this comes after the government granted approval for a 20% equity purchase in the project promoted by Africa's richest man. Now, the 650,000-barrel-per-day refinery owned by billionaire Aliko Dangote is under construction in Lagos. The refinery plans to start operations by January. Now, Mr. Basse, there will be increased oil refining in Nigeria following the approval of the new oil law. Now, do you see these impacting negatively on the environment?
Above all, what this means to us, why we're worried about this, is not about the big private refinery impacting the country negatively, but the fact that you have that big refinery right there at the shoreline of Lagos, you're going to have more pollution, you're going to have destruction of fisheries, you're going to impoverish the people, you're going to poison the people with all the toxic elements coming from the refinery, and then moreover, the country is going to say, well, we have all this oil, why should we move to renewable energy?
Contrary to expectations that the signing of the Petroleum Industry Act would automatically lead to the removal of fuel subsidy, the federal government of Nigeria says the subsidy will remain until a feasible framework is developed.
The PIB has actually deregulated the sector, but
That doesn't mean that there will be an immediate implementation of that price hike, of the deregulation. What the PIB provides is that products will be sold at market dictated prices. So it will not be shouldered by, it will be shouldered by all of us. This is the only fund that is targeted at the host communities in this country. Because all other such funds were not really targeted at the host community. You have the 13% derivation, which was also instituted to douse this problem. And many times, this 13% is not targeted at the host communities. So the 13% may be spent somewhere, and the problem is happening somewhere else.
Of course, most Nigerians are opposed to removal of the fuel subsidy, saying it will push up inflation.
To address some of the controversial details of the new law, our correspondent Folashade Ogunrede tells us more.
Since President Muhammadu Buhari signed the much-talked-about Petroleum Industry Bill into law, one of the most prominent concerns it has raised is whether or not the pump price of petrol will go up for as high as 300 naira per litre. Usually, the impact of fuel price hike is felt first in the public transportation system, where bus operators jack up fares and commuters pay more.
In every way, the driver or every transport company will have to increase the price of or the tariff at which they take to wherever it is that they are going to.
Looking at it, in the other hand, when I buy fuel at the rate of 300 and something naira, I'm likely to increase the transport fare so that I can meet up to go and come and buy the fuel again and go back.
It's going to affect a lot. Not only transportation will affect, it will affect even people selling foodstuff. It will affect anything that affects transport, that affects fuel, will affect every other thing.
For a standard living in a common man in Nigeria now, how can you buy fuel for 360 naira and you are receiving a minimum wage of 30,000 naira? Logic, how does that gel? It doesn't work.
The government has decided to maintain the petrol subsidy contrary to expectations. Now, what's your take on this decision?
You know, the question of oil subsidy is one thing that is so opaque that Nigerians don't understand what the subsidy is and where the subsidy comes from. Many times they've told us they've stopped paying subsidies, but then we find that they're still paying subsidies. So it's like something, there's something political beneath the subsidy argument. And if you ask me, the actual subsidy we have in the oil sector, the petroleum sector, is a subsidy provided by the environment that is being trashed, subsidy provided by the communities who are being polluted and contaminated, whose livelihoods are destroyed. And so we just hope that government will wake up one day and tell us exactly how much does the petrol imported or produced locally cost, and how much are we paying at the pump price, and stop playing politics with subsidies.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nimo Basay, for your insight on the new petroleum law in Nigeria. Let's take a short break now, and when we come back, we shall talk about global fashion brands polluting African rivers. Stay with us.
Global fashion brands polluting African rivers.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
A new report shows that production of clothing including for high street brands in Europe and the US, is killing Africa's rivers through polluting discharges of untreated industrial water. Now, the report by Water Witness International showcased the polluted rivers in Lesotho in Southern Africa and Tanzania to highlight the risks posed by global brands increasingly sourcing clothing from entrepreneurs in Africa, attracted by cheap labor and tax incentives.
Nick Hepworth, Water Witness International manager and author of the report, identified around 50 international brands that source or have purchased their clothes in African countries, including Zara from Inditex, ASOS and H&M. One of the rivers affected by untreated wastewater from factories producing garments for global brands is the Simbazi River that flows across Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Now, for an incisive analysis on how global fashion brands are involved directly or indirectly in polluting African water bodies in general and rivers in particular, we have contacted Dr. Nick Hepworth, the Water Witness International manager who authored the damning report. Thanks for joining us. Now, can you first tell us why these global brands prefer producing their products in African countries?
Sure. Africa still has just a fraction of the global trade with the fashion market, and it's shadowed by the big producers in Asia. But it's a really important potential driver of job creation and economic growth in Africa. For example, before the pandemic, selling clothes to the global fashion brands was worth about $4.6 billion a year to the African continent. And producers are drawn there by a combination of cheap labor costs and overheads, probably the cheapest labor on the planet, tax incentives from national governments keen to grow the sector, and favorable trade deals that have emerged over the past few years, which relieve duty on imports from Africa to the US and Europe.
Well, quite unfortunate there that cheap African labor is a major incentive for global fashion brands producing their products in Africa, and I guess that will qualify for modern slavery or neo-slavery.
The European Union has a comprehensive liability regime for damages to the environment based on the polluter pays principle. This legislation has pushed out manufacturers that disregard protection of the environment, forcing them to relocate to third world countries where there are less stringent laws. Why are these fashion brands disregarding the protection of the environment of African countries while they would not dare do the same in Western countries?
Well, many of the fashion brands are outsourcing production to middlemen, to factories which are largely owned by Asian companies across Africa. And again, they play a really important role in generating employment and export revenue. But the brands are also outsourcing pollution and impacts on water, because the regulatory controls that are in place are very weak or not enforced. And so by not enforcing strict standards on their suppliers, the brands are turning a blind eye on the pollution that their production and their supply chains are creating. National governments are often feel as though their hands are tied. They're reluctant to enforce pollution control on factories that employ thousands of people, because they fear that the production will simply shift next door.
The United States and the European Union have established programs which give African countries duty-free access to their consumer markets. In a bid to create employment for thousands of their citizens, most of these African countries rush to set up factories with little regard for the environment. The governments of the EU and the US pushed for agreements to produce these garments in Africa. Are they complicit in the destruction of the environment by these global fashion brands?
Absolutely. Just to that point, you know, it's really important, particularly given COVID and the climate emergency, that we do all we can to ensure that everybody has access to safe water, sanitation and hygiene, and is protected from droughts and floods. And the global supply chains and companies and brands producing in Africa have an important role to play. Certainly the governments that have negotiated improved trade deals have an important role to play to ensure that the companies the supply chains and the financiers behind this sector in Africa are compelled to comply with pollution control law and ethical standards of production. And they can do that in a number of ways, attaching a disclosure of good performance to the export and import licenses, for example, and enabling companies to be prosecuted and sanctioned for abuse of human rights and water, no matter where they work in the world.
A government can play a critical role if there is political will to implement tough environmental laws that will compel manufacturers to implement good manufacturing practices friendly to the ecosystem. Citizens have the right to water, and factories must be cognizant of this fact. An activist in Tanzania speaks here on the need to protect water from pollution.
Sote tuna haki ya maji safi na salama kwa matumizi ya binadamu na uhai. Tuna wajibu kuhakikisha vyanzo vyetu vya maji havichafuliwi.
Now, what should governments of consumer countries do to ensure that factories producing garments for these global fashion brands do not destroy the environment?
Well, we need to see strong and immediate political leadership to draft and enforce legislation which requires companies to meet basic standards of social justice and environmental protection throughout their supply chains. And also a requirement on the financiers and investments and the banks behind those companies to disclose performance and to divest from companies that continue to abuse water and local communities.
Now, consumers are gradually becoming more engaged in sustainability topics. Many now are demanding that fashion players uphold their social and environmental responsibilities. Now, what's the role of consumers in ensuring that the products they use are compliant to the protection of the environment?
That's a great question. You know, whether we like it or not, the global markets have a huge influence on the way we use the planet's resources and on communities across the planet. There's a really important role for consumers because markets respond to consumer demand. So we need consumers to step up to ask questions and demand the responsible use of water in the production of the food, of the clothes, of the computers that they consume. That's what's going to drive change, and that needs to happen and happen quickly.
Well, yes, indeed. There is need for urgent action to be taken to stop the pollution of African waters by global fashion brands. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you watching, and please do send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.